From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ralph Reed, the executive director of the Christian Coalition. He's influencing the course of American politics while trying to change the image of the religious right. The Coalition has become the leading political organization of Christian conservatives. Also today, Ron Howard, The Opie Years. The actor and film director tells us about starring in The Andy Griffith Show and his other work as a child actor. Howard last joined us to discuss directing his hit film Apollo 13. The Larry Sanders Show starts its new season tonight on HBO. David Bianculli has a review and a preview of TV Nation, which moves to Fox Friday night. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After backing the Republicans' Contract with America, in May, the Christian Coalition released a contract of their own, the Contract with the American Family. It calls for a constitutional amendment that would ease restrictions on prayer in schools and public places, and measures that would tighten restrictions on abortions and pornography, abolish federal programs for the arts, create a school voucher system, and provide tax relief for families. My guest, Ralph Reed, is the executive director of the Christian Coalition. The Coalition is the most powerful political group of Christian conservatives and is a force in the Republican presidential primary campaigns. Reed was appointed executive director of the Coalition by Pat Robertson, who founded the Coalition in 1989. Reed had previously served as executive director of the College Republican National Committee. I asked Ralph Reed first for an update on the status of the Contract with the American Family.
Well, as I think you know, we introduced the contract in a news conference held on Capitol Hill on May 17th. We announced at that time that in contrast to the original contract, this particular document has no specified deadline or timetable. We're not asking for these things to be acted upon in 100 days or even 200 days. We are indicating that we'd like as many of them to be voted on before the 1996 elections as possible, and we're seeing some real progress in that direction. Let me just mention a few. First of all, the Homemakers and Mothers' Rights Act, which allows women who work in the home to put the same amount of money in an IRA as women who work outside the home. That passed both chambers in the Republican budget resolution. It will now go to the tax committees. We expect that to pass, and we expect the president to sign it. The Internet Pornography Bill, which bans child pornography on the Internet and other computerized bulletin boards, passed in the Senate 86-14. We expect it to go to the House later this week or early next week. We expect it to pass there as well. The partial birth abortion bill, which outlaws certain draconian and very controversial abortion procedures where the child is partially delivered and then killed about two-thirds of the way down the birth canal, has cleared a judiciary subcommittee in the House. It's heading to full committee. We expect it to pass in the House and then go to the Senate. There are a number of other provisions, such as the school choice bill, the parental rights bill, and others that we expect to be acted upon probably after we get back from the August recess.
I'm wondering why the contract isn't pushing for some of the legislation that has been forwarded on a local level or that has been a mainstay of the Christian conservative agenda, such as anti-gay rights legislation, making abortion illegal.
Mm-hmm.
How come you're not pushing for that now?
Well, we obviously are a pro-life organization. Our position on that issue is identical to that of Mother Teresa. It's identical to that of the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference. It's identical to that of other compassionate and humane pro-life organizations. We believe in the sanctity of every innocent human life, whether born or unborn, aged, infirm, disabled, and elderly. I think if an amendment were offered to have a human life amendment to the Constitution, we would clearly support that. I think the reality is it's unlikely that we would have 290 votes in the House and 67 votes in the Senate. And I think there are votes to end taxpayer subsidies for the taking of innocent human life. I think there are votes to ban some of these controversial and late-term abortion procedures where a child can clearly survive outside the womb. What we're trying to do is while remaining principled and continuing to articulate our ultimate agenda, which is to protect the life of every human being, we're trying to achieve what's possible today. And I think that's what the responsible thing for us to do is. But we're never going to retreat. We're never going to walk away from our eloquent defense of every innocent human life.
What about anti-gay rights legislation?
Well, I think we have worked on those kinds of issues when they come up, but for the most part, that tends to be a local or state issue. It tends to be a situation where someone will have a special rights ordinance that provides for the granting of a right based on sexual preference. We clearly oppose those when those come up, but they generally tend to be more of a reaction to the efforts of the gay lobby to force their agenda. It's not usually us proactively proposing our own.
William Lacy, Bob Dole's chief strategist, has said that without having the significant support of the Christian right, a Republican can't win the nomination for the presidency or the general election. Do you agree with that?
I wouldn't really phrase it that way. I don't think that any single organization or any single constituency holds a veto over the nominee of the Republican Party. I think they clearly have a voice, but it's one voice among many. And we don't aspire to be to the Republican Party what I think the feminists and the unions have been to the Democratic Party, essentially dictating terms, making unreasonable demands. I think the more salient point is this, that if you go out and you ask the American people, what are the issues that you're most concerned about? They're concerned about the fraying of the social fabric, the coarsening of the culture, the breakup of the family, and a decline in values. Those are the kinds of issues that we have been raising in the public consciousness. And I think what we believe is that a candidate, any candidate of either party, who runs on those issues and says that they're going to use the bully pulpit of the presidency to address social, moral, and cultural decay in America is going to win a lot of support.
Of course, George Bush's presidential campaign the last time around was waged a lot on the basis of family values. And a lot of people, even a lot of Republicans, think that that helped blow his chances of winning. What do you think you should do differently this time around?
George Bush wasn't defeated because he was pro-life or because he was pro-family or because he stood for strengthening the family. George Bush lost because, number one, he broke his pledge on taxes. He promised not to raise them, and then he did. And because he was perceived as out of touch with an economy that many thought was in a double-dip recession. And I think if you go back and you look at the Clinton campaign, you will see that they really ran on those issues. Economic anxiety, job loss, middle-class families falling behind. That was really their message. Of the 16% of the electorate that voted on, quote, family values, they broke 3-1 for George Bush. So the family positions, the values positions, the cultural positions that George Bush took were an asset. They were not a liability, but they were not enough to overcome the albatross that hung around his neck in the form of the economy. Having said that, there are some things that I think can be learned from the 92 election, not the least of which is when you speak to these issues, do it in a way that is inclusive rather than exclusive. Do it in a way that embraces all of your listeners. Do it in a way that doesn't try and pin the blame for the breakdown of the family on any particular race, on any particular class of people, like single mothers, for example, as happened in the case of the Murphy Brown speech. Instead, make it about the government, because I think the government and its policies is what's accelerated the breakdown of the family. And I think what we ought to do is instead of blaming single mothers in the inner city, we ought to say it's really the welfare state that is the problem, and that's why we need to reform it and get rid of it. I think that's a much more optimistic message.
You once described, this is when you were working more on a local level with the Christian Coalition, you once described your tactics as stealth politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you run on issues like taxes and crime and then reveal the real agenda after being elected, like illegalizing abortion, anti-gay rights. I think some people are afraid that what you're doing now is a form of stealth politics, that your inclusive language is camouflaging a more extremist agenda. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say to that that, you know, there are a lot of things that you could accuse the Christian Coalition of being. But, you know, we have been on the cover of just about every news magazine in America. I have appeared on just about every television program that there is. We are provide an open access to the media, those that we agree with and those that we don't agree with. And I think you could say a lot of things about us, but stealth isn't one of them. I mean, we're one of the most visible and prominent public policy organizations in the country. I don't think there's really any ambiguity about where we stand on the issues. I think when it comes to religious liberty and school prayer, we are for it as long as it doesn't involve teachers and principals and school administrators imposing religion on students. When it comes to abortion, I don't think there's any question about where we stand. We're a pro-family, pro-life organization, and we favor protecting innocent human life. And when it comes to the issue of gay rights or special rights based on sexual preference, we favor traditional civil rights protection based on gender, age, disability, religious affiliation, and color of skin and racial background. We do not favor protection based on sexual preference. And so there's no effort to be anything but upfront about where we stand. And by the way, we don't have to hide where we stand because the positions that we take are majority positions supported by most Americans. Not all, but most. We did a survey on our contract with the American Family, and between 60 and 90% of the American people support every item in that contract. So this is a mainstream agenda.
My guest is Ralph Reed, executive director of the Christian Coalition. He's also written a book called Politically Incorrect. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ralph Reed, the executive director of the Christian Coalition. The coalition was founded by Pat Robertson in 1989 after his failed bid to become the Republican presidential nominee. Robertson hired Reed to develop and lead the coalition. Robertson is well known for his show The 700 Club, which is broadcast on his cable network, The Family Channel. Robertson's 1991 bestseller, The New World Order, remains controversial for its elaborate theory about a 200-year-old hidden plan to replace the Christian order with a one-world government and monetary system. I'd be interested in hearing your reaction to some of the views he's expressed in his book, The New World Order. And let me just quote a little bit of it. He writes, "I am convinced that for the past 200 years, the term New World Order has been the code phrase of those who desired to destroy the Christian faith and what Pope Pius XI termed the Christian social order. They wish to replace it with an occult-inspired world socialist dictatorship. This book will place the origin, meaning, and ultimate destiny of the New World Order within the clear purview of Bible prophecy, so that you can understand what God has to say about one world government." Do you believe in what Pat Robertson has described as the hidden plan to destroy the Christian faith and replace it with a new world order?
Well, I think you have to remember that what Pat was talking about when he wrote that book in 1991, it was 4.5 years ago. It was at the time when the United States had really gone to the United Nations and engaged in a multilateral attempt to topple the government of Iraq. And it was done through the auspices of the United Nations. And the point that Pat makes in that book is that he is very concerned that when the United States begins to, in effect, subsume its own national security interests under the more global and internationalist concerns of any global body, but in this case particularly the UN, there is a danger of A, American national security interests not being properly advanced, as I think frankly was the case when we allowed Saddam Hussein to stay in power.
If you don't mind my interrupting for a second, you're trying to cast this in terms of American foreign policy and the war in the Gulf, and Pat Robertson is really describing here a 200-year-old conspiracy between the establishment, occultists, humanists, He writes about the humanist occultic sphere, the devil. He writes occultists and Satanists are behind this too. It is self-evident that Masonic beliefs and rituals flow from the occult, beliefs from Egyptian mystics, Chinese Buddhism, and the ancient mysteries of the Hebrew Kabbalah have been resuscitated to infuse their doctrine. What a splendid training ground for a new world, new age citizen.
Mm-hmm.
The human potential movement is in this. New age religions are involved in this 200-year-old conspiracy.
Well, if I could finish answering the question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that you have to place a book, any book, in the context in which it was written. You wouldn't sit here and quote citations out of Betty Friedan's, you know, Feminine Mystique without understanding the time in which she wrote. Dr. Robertson has said himself that he would not write that book today because it was contemporaneous to his concerns flowing out of the Gulf War. But the second concern speaks to some of these spiritual issues that you're raising that are covered in the book. And that is that those who are concerned with building a global government or global order often do so without a sensitivity to the spiritual yearnings of the Jewish and the Christian faith. And the specific thing that he talked about in the book that no one ever quotes is that his greatest concern was that that kind of a globalist order could be used to ultimately move against Israel and drive Israel into the sea and undermine the sovereignty of the state of Israel and the Jewish people. And you will remember that when Saddam Hussein was firing Scud missiles at the Israelis, the Israeli government was pressured by both the UN and the American government not to respond. And so those were his concerns. Now, having said that, I think you have to remember that Pat Robertson wears a number of hats. He is a religious broadcaster. He is an ordained minister. He is also involved in political activity. It is a mistake, and just so you know, to clarify, sometimes people will take something that he said on the 700 Club or wrote in a book that was intended as a spiritual message. And maybe they perceive it this way, but I want to disabuse anyone who does of this notion. Not everything that he says is the political program or the legislative agenda of the Christian Coalition. We are a public policy organization. We're trying to legislate tougher laws against crime and drugs, safer neighborhoods, strong families, and better schools. If someone gets up and, for example, presents a gospel message or view or delivers their view of the spiritual nature of a particular issue, you can agree or disagree with their view on that, but they're not trying to legislate it.
I just wanted to read one more paragraph because I think that the language you're using to explain Pat Robertson is so different from the language he uses in the book. He writes, "To those of us who realize the invisible spiritual dimension of the struggle to overthrow the existing world order and its Christian roots, the emergence of a new age world religion is of paramount importance because the human potential movement, as if part of a continuum, invariably leads to psychic power, and occult power leads straight to demonic power, and these lead in turn to a single source of evil identified by the Bible as Satan, the mm-hmm. adversary, the devil, the accuser, Lucifer, the light one, or Abaddon, the one who rules over hell and destruction."
Right.
I mean, he's writing about the devil and occultists, right, and New Age religion.
And C.S. Lewis wrote the Screwtape Letters, which are considered a classic, in which he talks about the idea of the devil. I mean, you know, there are millions of people in America who believe in God, who believe in the devil, who believe in angels. I mean, there was a recent survey by U.S. News and World Report.
No, I realize
in
that.
In which 90% of the American people said they believed in angels.
Yes.
That doesn't make them bizarre individuals. Getting back to my earlier point, I'm not sure what this has to do with the legislative agenda of the Christian Coalition.
Glad you asked, because I can answer that. Since Pat Robertson is the creator of the Christian Coalition, a lot of people are wondering if there's an almost good cop, bad cop thing going on, that he's the hardliner, that he has very extremist, some would say even irrational views, and that you're the political insider, the good cop, who has a much more mainstream, more inclusive agenda that perhaps might be camouflaging a more extreme agenda.
You know what that reminds me of? That reminds me of conspiracy theories on the right that Hillary Clinton is really running the White House. There are conspiracy theories on the left, and there are conspiracy theories on the right. The reality is this.
Excuse me, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory to ask about the discrepancy between the founder of the group and the executive director of the group.
There is no discrepancy in the quotations that you just read and the political legislative agenda of the Christian Coalition. I mean, what you're saying is Pat Robertson believes in God, believes in angels, and believes there's a devil, and therefore I consider him to be an odd individual. And therefore, when the Christian Coalition goes out and lobbies for safer schools and for tougher laws against crime and drugs and religious liberty, that suggests to me that there's a good cop, bad cop. And all I'm saying to you is you have to remember that this is an individual who wears a number of different hats. He is a religious figure. He has a religious broadcasting network. And he speaks to that flock about his spiritual views. He is not attempting to legislate those views, and those views are not part of the political agenda of the Christian Coalition.
So do you see you and he as representing, finally, the same agenda?
Oh, absolutely. We have a board of directors. We have 50 state chairmen. I consult with him and the other board members on a regular basis in coming up with our legislative agenda. He had a great deal of input into our contract. I think he's fully supportive of it.
Finally, I want to quote something that you said in 1990. You said, what Christians have got to do is to take back this country one precinct at a time, one neighborhood at a time, and one state at a time. I honestly believe that in my lifetime, we will see a country once again governed by Christians and Christian values. Would you say that, and would you say that in the same way today?
Well, first of all, I don't think I ever said it. I think that the source on that is called the Religious News Service from 1990, and no one's ever been able to find a primary source. And I didn't say it, at least I don't think I said it. It is not reflective of my views either then or now. Let me tell you what I do want. I do want to see a country in which faith is treated as one of the legitimate voices among many legitimate voices that influences public policy. And I don't mean just from the right. I mean from the left as well. I think if Jesse Jackson is going to be included in our public debate, and I think he ought to be, then I think that religious conservatives ought to be included. We don't exclude anyone on the left because they happen to wear a priest's collar or because they happen to be an ordained minister. Bill Gray, after all, who's currently the head of the United Negro College Fund, was until recently the chairman of the House Budget Committee. One of the most powerful members of Congress on Capitol Hill. And he flew home every weekend and preached a sermon in the pulpit of the church where he remained the pastor. And I think my point is that faith is part of what's right with America. It's not part of what's wrong with America. I don't want to exclude anyone from the process, but I do want to include people based on that unique moral flavor that they bring to our debate.
Is there a room at the table in your vision for secular people and for atheists?
Absolutely. No question about it. I don't think that this is ultimately a theological or theocratic agenda. There are some Christians who don't agree with my politics, who share my religion. And there are other non-believers who don't share my religion but share my politics. I mean, Jimmy Carter is an example of a deeply committed born-again Christian who doesn't agree with me on very many issues. So he and I share the same faith, but we have very divergent views on the issues. I think conversely, there are people out there who may not agree with my theology, but agree with everything I stand for politically.
Well, Ralph Reed, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. Good to be with you.
Ralph Reed is the executive director of the Christian Coalition and the author of the book Politically Incorrect. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A couple of weeks ago, Ron Howard talked with us about directing the hit film Apollo 13. Coming up, he returns to talk about his early career as a child actor, back in the days when he was known for playing Opie on The Andy Griffith Show. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Larry Sanders Show, which is beginning a new season, and TV Nation, which has moved to Fox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The director of the number one film, Apollo 13, was a familiar face to Americans as a child. For better or worse, Ron Howard will probably always be known as Opie on The Andy Griffith Show. A couple of weeks ago, we talked to Ron Howard about the making of Apollo 13. He's back today to talk about his early years in show business. Howard also starred in the film American Graffiti and its TV cousin Happy Days. He made his directorial debut at the age of 23 with the Roger Corman film Grand Theft Auto. He went on to direct Splash, Cocoon, Parenthood, Backdraft, and The Paper. Ron Howard has made one of the most successful transitions from acting to directing. He told me his interest in directing dates back to his days at The Andy Griffith Show.
We had a number of directors who had been actors. They talked about how much they enjoyed directing. And I also used to watch my father, Rance Howard, direct some theater. And so I was fascinated by the job. I loved hanging around with the actors. The environment on The Andy Griffith Show was very, very collaborative. Andy was a kind of taskmaster, a kind of an easygoing taskmaster. But the scripts were always being worked on, always being developed. Nothing ever went on autopilot on that show. And so it was fascinating to see that, the creative side. I also really enjoyed the technical side. I loved hanging around with the camera crew. They were fascinating people. I liked seeing, you know, how the cinematographer lit the set and what lenses were chosen and why. And it didn't take me long to realize that the director was the person who got to sort of hang out and play with everybody. The actors on the one hand, the crew and the technical folks on the other. And the job just always attracted me. Now, later, I appreciated the potential for the autonomy. Actors are always waiting to get hired. And, you know, if you're not an absolute superstar, you're sort of at everyone's beck and call. And I honestly didn't look at myself and my work and feel I was going to be a superstar. I wanted to have a little more control over my career and the work that I'd be doing. And I think in some ways I didn't want to be typecast. And I knew that as an actor I was going to be. But as
wholesome?
As wholesome, everyday kind of guy. I mean, there were limited kinds of roles I was going to be have an opportunity to play. And as a director, there were all kinds of stories I felt I could get involved with.
I know your father was a writer and director. Was your mother in show business too?
Both my parents were and are primarily actors, although my dad has done some directing and writing as well.
Did your parents want you to act when you were young?
Yeah, they did. They had some reservations about it initially. And the very first job, I think the only reason they allowed it to happen was because it was an opportunity for all of us to go to Europe. My dad was going to play a very small part in this movie called The Journey. This was 1958.
So you were four.
I was four. Through the casting director, he saw that they were looking for kids, and he just sort of joked around and said, I have a son who's a fine actor. I had not done anything professionally at that point, but he'd used me in a couple of summer stock plays just when they needed a little kid to just sort of walk across stage, and I'd been in one little B movie that he was in where they needed a baby who would cry. I think that's when I was about 18 months old. But more importantly, I seemed to pick up the dialogue for some of the shows that he was rehearsing, that he was directing or acting in. And we had some scenes that we could do. We had this one scene from the play Mr. Roberts, mm-hmm. and he would play Mr. Roberts and I would play Ensign Pulver. And we would do this scene, and people would get a kick out of it. So I went in and we did this scene for the casting director, and I wound up getting a part two. And that meant that they would pay for my mother's way across, and we'd get to go to Europe. So they thought, well, it's a small role. It's a once-in-a-lifetime kind of an opportunity to see Europe. We'll take the money. We'll put it in a separate fund for college, and he never has to do this again. But I think they saw that I took to it. I remember enjoying it, a lot. And later, they kept putting me out on auditions, and I was getting roles, and And then I remember them periodically saying, you know, if you don't want to do this, you don't have to do this. And I really felt, you know, I knew they weren't kidding. I knew they meant it.
What'd you do with the money that you earned as a child?
Well, my parents were very good about saving it, very conscientious. And
saving it for you?
Yeah. And very concerned about, you know, sort of not exploiting my situation, and later my brother Clint's. And also the state of California has a law called the Jackie Coogan Law, because Jackie Coogan was a child actor who had most of his money spent by his parents. And this law states that if I think it's 20 or 25% of whatever is earned has to go into bonds and saved for, you know, when the child matures. So, you know, I had a pretty good stake by the time I was 18.
A lot of people who were child actors ended up in self-help groups for former child actors who were really having serious emotional problems, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of child actors have ended up with substance abuse problems or emotional disorders, or it turns out we're in really dysfunctional families. Did you not have to deal with any of those kinds of problems?
Yeah, but it's so rare. It's so rare. You know, I don't really like my situation to be used as as much of an example, because, you know...
You think you were the exception.
I think that my parents were extraordinary in their maturity, their sense of their own duty, and the responsibility they felt at once they'd exposed myself and my brother to this. You know, the support was there, and it was very sophisticated kind of support too, because they knew what they were doing. Yeah, I have a kind of a theory about it. I experienced this. It is very unnerving when you've been a somewhat successful child actor, and you go through what's always sort of called the awkward stage, the awkward years, which means, I don't know, when you get to be 14, 15 years old, and the production company, it's not just because you look gawky or something and have acne all of a sudden. The production company at that point can usually hire someone who's 18 to play the role they would hire you for. And then they don't have to worry about child welfare rules and restrictions. And that's a very significant production consideration. So it becomes very difficult to get work from that time when you're about 14, 15, through until you're 18. And so here you are going through the pains of adolescence. We all know what that's like. It's the hormones are raging, I read something somewhere that you actually lapse into what would, you know, clinical insanity at times when you're going through adolescence. So here you're living through this thing, and meanwhile you're being rejected time after time, mm-hmm. as you go up on these interviews, and it's very, very difficult not to personalize that.
How did you get through that? Were you rejected a lot then?
I was, yeah, for a while. And that's when I realized how much I missed how dedicated I was to having a career. And first time I felt kind of needy about it. And I was fortunate in that I wound up on a television series that, as a regular, that carried me through those years. It was a bad show.
What was the show?
It was called The Smith Family. It starred Henry Fonda.
And it lasted
for 2 years. Well, it was pretty bad. You probably never saw it. But it did last for 2 years. And it had this theme song, Primrose Lane, Life's a Family on Primrose Lane. People remember this campy theme song more than they ever remember the series. But I did get to work with Henry Fonda, who was had known my father for a lot of years. And even though it was a very quiet, very professional guy, but who kept to himself, he talked to me a lot about film, and he really encouraged me to become a director. It wound up being a real good time for me professionally.
Was acne a problem for you, and did you have embarrassing voice change transitions?
Well, I'll never forget this one director. I was having, I guess, a bad acne day, and I remember him coming up and saying, "Oh God, oh geez," and they're calling in the makeup guy, and I kept poking at this one huge whitehead I had, and And he said, oh, man, God, his, well, he's just got a huge pimple, the director said. It's huge. It's huge. It's all over his whole neck, practically. And I remember just saying, well, let's just pop it and get rid of it. And it's like, I wasn't a very defiant kind of person, but I was a little ticked off that he was embarrassing me that way.
That's a nightmare come true for anybody who's ever been a teenager.
Well, show business is not always, people are not always at their coolest and most collected when they're in the middle of making a movie. I mean, the sun was going down. He was going to lose the shot.
Mm-hmm.
I can relate now, but it bugged the heck out of me then. But yeah, you know, I had to go down to the dermatologist and go on a special diet and all that stuff. And it was kind of a pain.
My guest is Ron Howard. He directed Apollo 13. We'll talk more about his early days in show business after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ron Howard. When you were shooting the Andy Griffith Show, did you understand a place like Mayberry?
No, I didn't. I didn't have any sense that it was any kind of a sort of almost mythic town. To me, it was all real. You know, my father, Rance Howard. I always said he should have become an acting teacher, And my brother and I were both blessed to have him teaching us the real fundamentals. And all he would preach in preparing for those shows was just honesty, honest reactions. And I, early on, he had a conversation with Andy where he said, they always have the kids in these shows, in situation comedies, be brats. And they really are kids that, you kind of think, God, somebody ought to just discipline that kid. And I know you get laughs and things like that, but do you think there'd be any value to the Andy-Opie relationship being, more of a real relationship where when the kid gets out of line, the father does something about it and teaches and the kid respects the father instead of being just a wise guy all the time. And Andy really took to that. And that is the way the Andy Opie relationship evolved, and it's one of the things that differentiates it in a lot of ways from what we're accustomed to seeing on sitcoms.
After being a child actor yourself, are there any things you try to do or try not to do when you're working with children, when you're directing them, like you had to do in Parenthood, for instance?
Well, yes, I don't have time to be the kind of teacher that my father was. But I do try to talk to the parents and talk to the children in a way so that they will understand, really what's going on with the scene. And some kids respond to that and some don't. Unfortunately, you occasionally find yourself in a situation where you're treating a child actor kind of like a trained animal, especially if they're really, really young. You got bells and whistles and you're making noise off on the side and I'm acting up a storm and standing on my head trying to get them to giggle. And it can be really hard work and feel kind of silly. But every once in a while, you bump into a child actor who just simply understands,
mm-hmm.
Even if they're only 7, 8 years old. And it's really fun. And I relate to that so well because I think that I understood.
When you work with children now and you see how their parents interact with them, do you sometimes really see trouble ahead?
Yes. Occasionally, I really do. And
do you talk to the parents about that?
I try to, but I would never go to a parent and, look, I'm a parent of 4. I don't want somebody telling me what to do. Or,
mm-hmm.
We're on our own journey trying to figure out how to handle these things with reading and talking and But I usually find myself in a conversation with the parents of the children, and I try to talk a little bit about my experiences and mostly encourage the parents to take the pressure off the kids. Try not to make it be about did they get the role or did they not get the role. So it's not a thing about being judged. and when they go on auditions, and also try to encourage the children and the parents to use this opportunity to really learn the craft. A lot of kid actors struggle as they get older because the little tricks that they used simply don't work anymore. Now they look ridiculous.
What kind of tricks are you talking about?
Oh, cute little smiles, mannered little behaviors that aren't very realistic, and they're not honest. But you know, they're cute. They make you smile if you see it. You can't help yourself. But that's one thing if a kid's 7 or 8, and another thing if they get to be 14, 15. Is, you know, then it just seems mannered and fake, and it's not about anything honest that's going on in the scene.
I know what it's like for me when I pull out the scrapbook of the old pictures and I see myself as a child. What's it like for you when you see a rerun of The Andy Griffith Show? Does it still have any impact?
Well, it's almost the same kind of experience that you're talking about. I mean, it's more home movies to me than a television show. And you know, I can't remember the last time I sat down and watched an episode of The Andy Griffith Show or Happy Days start to finish. But when I'm cruising around, occasionally I'll bump into one and watch a scene or two, and it brings back a lot of memories. And sometimes I wince. Sometimes I hate what I was doing, you know.
Right.
You just never stop being self-critical, I suppose.
Ron Howard, he directed Apollo 13, and he spoke with us about making that film a couple of weeks ago. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton spoke on affirmative action today. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Mara Liasson is filing a story for us, Terry, on what the president said and the political decisions that went into what he said. The governor of California is going to ask the regents of the university system there to do away with affirmative action. We'll talk to a professor at Berkeley who has had a hand in developing their programs about what it's meant and how it's worked. Also, David Malpas has a piece from Atlanta on the Olympics that are coming. We're covering the hearings into the events at Waco, and we will have more on Bosnia.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. TV critic David Bianculli says he's been bored to tears by TV this summer. But with two old favorites returning with new episodes this week, his tears have been replaced by smiles.
If you've taken the summer off from watching TV, you haven't missed much. As a matter of fact, you haven't really missed anything. But even though CBS, NBC, and ABC are remaining as dull as ever, there's suddenly a reason to go back to your TV set. Three reasons, actually. Two from HBO and one from Fox. The two HBO shows are The Larry Sanders Show and Dream On, both of which begin new seasons tonight. Dream On isn't quite as sharp as it used to be, but these saucy HBO versions are still a lot funnier than the sanitized repeats shown on Fox. And they're fresh, which, when everything else in sight is a rerun, counts for a lot. The big thrill, though, is The Larry Sanders Show, one of the very best comedies anywhere on TV today. Gary Shandling stars in the title role as a talk show host planning for and presenting his Johnny Carson-style TV talk show. The cast is brilliant, especially Rip Torn as Larry's manager Artie and Jeffrey Tambor as Larry's on-air sidekick Hank. The new season begins with a staff meeting in Larry's office, but with everyone distracted by coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial on Larry's TV set. Discussion turns to whether Larry should book Cato Kalin on the show, after which Hank chimes in with some thoughts of his own.
Hank, we're trying to talk about ways to keep the show fresh. Okay. People, any thoughts?
Better guess?
Better jokes?
I'm sorry, were we supposed to come with ideas?
Hank?
What guess, Paul?
Well, Cato Kalin's people keep haranguing me.
Cato Kalin has people?
What do you think, Larry?
Huh?
Cato Kalin?
No.
Ditto.
Big ratings.
Big ratings? No.
You know what's really sad? Is that people have forgotten the real victims of this crime. I live on Rockingham, you know, and my property values have just gone right in the toilet.
The Simpson plotline continues through the show as Hank is convinced of O.J.'s innocence and one of the staff members sets out to convince him otherwise. It's a sequence too good to spoil, but Hank's final reaction is priceless. It's also so outrageous it can only be seen on unedited pay cable TV. This show, all by itself, would be enough to cure the summer doldrums. But wait, there's more. Michael Moore. This Friday, Fox has the intelligence to bring back a series that NBC had the stupidity to dump, TV Nation, starring Roger and Me guerrilla filmmaker Michael Moore. On this second season opener, Moore gets help from lots of correspondents, one of whom is Janine Garofalo, who also co-stars on The Larry Sanders Show, so it's a big week for her. Janine tries to crash a private beach, while other correspondents do things like profile a crime scene cleanup crew or rush to Mississippi and buy some slaves the day before the state finally ratifies the 13th Amendment. Then there's Moore himself, who takes an ex-convict named Louis Bruno and helps him run for public office. The campaign slogan Moore chooses for Bruno? He's a pro, he's a con.
As of today, over 100 people have filed with the federal government to run for president in next year's election.
They include Billy Joe Clegg, who says that God gives him original ideas to serve America, like calling out the National Guard to close down all abortion clinics.
And Frank Barella, who wants the voters to know that he's never engaged in a homosexual act and that his SAT scores are 470 verbal, 260 math.
So we thought, hey, why not run our own candidate from TV Nation? Meet Louis Bruno. Louis's been arrested more than 20 times for assault, weapons charges. He was our man.
No. President of the United States. You, Louis Bruno.
Hey, I'd give it a shot.
Of course you're thinking, hey, an ex-con can't run for president. Well, that's the beauty of our Constitution. There are only two requirements for the highest office in the land. You must be 35. You must be born in the U.S.
TV Nation is just like The Larry Sanders Show. It's sassy, it's smart, and it's a perfect cure for the summertime blues.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Greenlease, research assistants from Becky Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.